podcast brought to you by the Triad Network. This podcast is designed to share trending topics occurring within the world and our communities and bring them a behavioral and mental health perspective.
Welcome to Behavior Health Today. I'm your host, Dr. Graham Taylor, and today we are going to be concluding our conversation with Saj Razvi, the Director of Education at Psychedelic Somatic Institute, on psychedelic therapy. In our last episode, we talked about what psychedelic therapy is, who's benefiting from it, and the various substances that are being used, and why we utilize psychedelic therapy to access the trauma that is underneath secondary conscious to promote healing. We'll resume our conversation today talking about the role of the therapist and the psychoanalytic process used to manage and guide the client through their session. Again, we apologize for the audio quality, but I know the content in this episode will be very valuable to you.
If you would, walk us through, and I'm going to talk about the role of a therapist in just a minute, and I'm going to get a little bit more understanding of that in the transferential process, but walk us through, somebody comes in, they're interested. How do you prep them for this? How do you begin to introduce the psychedelic? And what does a psychedelic, somatic, interactional psychotherapy session actually look like?
Okay. So let me maybe set up the way this happens predominantly in the world of mental health right now in terms of the research settings and things like that. So there is what I would call a sitter model, right? And it's non-directive and mostly non-interactional. So I have a little blurb here from David Nutt of Imperial College. He runs a psychedelic research program there. The drug session itself is given in a room with soft ambient lighting and a comforting soundtrack, which may contribute to the therapeutic value as well. There are generally two therapists present in the room, ideally one male and one female, who are there to provide reassurance, medical cover, and care. Now, this is the important part. Okay. They only talk with the patient if the patient wants them to, which they generally do not. It is important to note that there is no expectation of conversation during the trip and no direction by either therapist of the patient's speech or thought. It is the next day in the integration session that the content of the trip is discussed and interpreted and psychotherapeutic benefits derived. So that's a traditional model, the sitter model, right? So basically, you have a therapist team and the client is wearing eye shades, they're wearing headphones. So in a big way, they're kind of isolated in their own little bubble from the therapist team that they're in the same room with, but sound-wise and visually, they're not in the same space. The essence of that model is that the magic happens between the encounter of the client's consciousness and the medicine, right? And maybe if the client gets really scared or something, they may say, you know, hold my hand. But for the most part, the therapist is quiet. They're sitting in kind of a meditative stance through the entire thing, right? They're not even talking to the client mostly. And my suspicion, this is complete speculation, I'll say, is that I think that that's the model we came to in the 1950s because, again, traditional talk therapy does not pair very well with the psychedelic state, right? People are in a very altered state of consciousness. And it's like, you know, all the things that we might do in traditional therapy, the interventions don't pair very well. So I think rather than doing something that doesn't dance well with psychedelic consciousness, I think we decided to do nothing at all. Right. And the good news is that that model works, right? We see significant benefit when people just engage that. And the therapeutic benefits, again, happen not the day of, but in an integration session following, right? So integration is an important part of this model. So what we're doing is something quite different than that. We're saying that, you know, instead of trying to do interventions that are part of secondary consciousness, let's design interventions that enter into sort of the dream state with people. And so in terms of the focus, we have an interactional component, right? If a client doesn't have interaction in their session, typically they will tend to have a transpersonal experience. So in other words, introducing relationship, introducing human beings into the psychedelic space of the client's consciousness means that we're all of a sudden moving the session from a transpersonal experience to a more personal experience. It becomes about them and their healing and their biographical material, as it were. Yeah. And the basis of this is that most of the reasons why people enter into therapy is because of wounding that they've experienced in relationship, right? I can count on my hand one hand, the amount of clients I've had in 17 years that have come in for something like just a car accident or a single event trauma, the vast majority of people who come into therapy are coming because they have things that have happened to them in their childhood, in their family of origin.
It's and relational. So,
and it's relational, right?
Material, absolutely.
It's highly relational. And so our sense is that if you're going to need relational interventions to heal relational wounding, right? Yeah. You can't do it without that. So that's the interactional component. We're saying therapists be a player in the psychedelic reality of the client. And very typically that leads to negative transference coming out and being projected onto the therapist, which we can touch on here because that's a wild, powerful process. The somatic component is also essential to the model that we've developed because, again, your cognition, your insight, your, you know, that connecting the dots, your understanding is all secondary consciousness features and processes. So instead of going there, we're having people move much more towards their felt sense, their emotional reality, their proprioception, their interoception, basically what their gut feels like, what their nervous system is doing. And we find that with that focus, we can kick off these homeostatic processes that we call waves.
Yes. That's brilliant. Yeah. In the videos that I've watched, and you're talking about the somatic piece of this, I'm impressed also, like you're just teeing us up here with, is the role of the therapist in this. And I'm impressed with that psychoanalytic kind of psychodynamic transference piece in this process and its profound impact on those that are going through that relational or familial component of this. Let me ask a quick question. Yeah. I watched a video, and folks that are listening, you can go on Saj's site that we're going to be giving you information about at the end of our time today and watch these videos. They are powerful, powerful videos. And you see this process unfolding in such a beautiful manner. Sometimes it appears a little scary, but it's controlled. It's managed. It's actually quite loving as you watch, you know, the therapist kind of help the person through it. I had a question in one of the videos. Both of the faces are kind of hard to see. They're kind of blacked out. Are you the therapist that's working with a gentleman that kind of ends up in your lap or is kind of pushing against you? He had the negative father transference. And
yeah, that's me.
Mm-hmm. Man, you were brilliant in that. Truly, it's phenomenal. Because what you're talking about in your writings is that there's this charged interactions and the patient's going to kind of hand you a relational role.
Yeah.
Little, you know, you might have some idea, but they're going to hand you that role. And what they need you to be in that process. And then right then, that projection, it's active and it is alive and you can see it in these videos. What I'm watching you do in that video is that you're not correcting, you're not rejecting, you're not trying to give him a corrective experience or talk him out of it. Instead, you're allowing him just to be in it and explore the details of it and let him respond because that's his truth. And then watching to see what happens in that processing of their truth and what they work through in a resolution-based way, in a correcting way that changes how he gets to hold and see that. Brilliant work in that.
Yeah, thank you, Graham. I think what you're describing, boy, there's so many things to say about that, but I think what you're describing is that there are two main processes that we look for in a session, right? So one is what you've already pointed to, the corrective, right? So one of the things that the client in that video that you're pointing to says about themselves is that they feel disgusting. Right. And so most of our impulses as therapists is to sort of provide a corrective and say, no, you're not disgusting, or no, you know, I don't experience you that way. And so my sense of corrective is a little different than that. So on the one hand, I do not want to argue with the client's reality at all, right? Because again, if it lives in there, we want it to emerge more. We want it to engage it. And so I would say something like, even though you're disgusting, I am right here with you.
Yes.
Yeah. Even though all these bad things are happening, we're in this together, right? So we're having this real joining thing that happens there where, you know, we're insisting on relationship no matter where the client goes in their process.
Right? You're helping the patient in that moment do the within work, but you also move it into the between work. He tells you in his video that you're going to get bored with me.
Yeah. So we're not looking to solve anything. We're just insisting on relationship. And so there's an idea that I think many of your listeners might become familiar with, is this idea of a window of tolerance, meaning that typically we try to keep the client from becoming too activated or too hypoactivated, which is, you know, not too much arousal, not too much dissociation or numbing. And so the problem with that model, I think, is that trauma lives in the extremes. Trauma lives in the activation, it lives in the dissociation. So what we're suggesting is, no, go there, but take me with you. Right. Yeah. So you're welcome to dissociate. You're welcome to go completely numb, but tell me about the numbness. Tell me about, you know, everything that you're feeling right now. Walk me in that world with you. Right. So that's one side of it. That's the corrective. Now, the other side is what I would say is supporting the wave. And you'll notice in that video that I do a bunch of those relational correctives and to sort of build that foundation. And then at some point we turn and then begin to say to the client that, you know, he'll say to me, because he was dealing with sort of an attachment with his father and some level of neglect. And he'll say things to me like, he thinks that I'm bored. He thinks that I don't have time for him in the session. And so I'll agree with him, right? I'll say, yeah, I'm bored. Now come back to your experience. Come back to what it's like to be you right now. And so what we find is when we step into that negative transferential role that his system is begging to hand me, right? His system is just saying, please be this for me. Please be my dad who rejected me, right? And once we become that in the session, then you'll see that autonomic wave just turn on in a much bigger way, which you do in that video. So yeah, the basics of this is this, the idea that whenever somebody has a traumatic event that takes place in their family of origin, their event memory system that's recording this experience records the entire scene of the crime, meaning that, you know, they've internalized the dad that wasn't there for them. They've internalized their position in it. And so when it comes to processing this and having all of it emerge, well, it emerges in the room as transference, right? So the big picture, I would say, sort of contains all of this is reenactment, right? I think our systems are hell-bent on reenacting the places in our lives where we got crushed. And so the more that we can hold that reenactment process in the therapy, the better, right? So in other words, if your client's system is hell-bent on reenactment and they're looking for a parent that betrayed them or rejected them, and if you as a therapist are not able to hold that role, well, guess what? It's still there, right? It's still supercharged. It's just going to go to somebody else in their life. It's going to go to the next most significant relationship in their life, which is their spouse or, you know, somebody in their family. So my sense is that if you are going to be working with family of origin issues, which pretty much all of us are in the mental health field, and certainly if you're going to be doing psychedelic work, it is ethically incumbent upon you to learn how to work with negative transference. And it is, unfortunately, it is not something that's taught in graduate schools anymore. It's just considered a relic of the psychodynamic world. But I think we threw the baby out with the bathwater on that one. I think it is an incredibly relevant and powerful process. It's a relevant pathway that we can use in the psychedelic session for that experience to arise and play out in the room.
You're really saying that while the patient does the within work, I'm disgusting, like you said, or whatever the core self-belief is, then they get to do the between work with the therapist in that transferential role. But that therapist is going to have to, you know, kind of bring their seat backs and their tray tables to the full and upright position, because it's going to be in the negative transferential piece, maybe pretty intense. And it's not about them, but it's a role that you're saying we get to come alongside the patient in, because they need to reenact this. It's the repetition compulsion. We're compelled to repeat those patterns of behavior, trying to put a different ending on them, but we can't at that secondary consciousness level. But it's the primary conscious that you're saying, here's how we can begin to work this through and resolve it. Yeah. And it's the part that crushed us. But this is where the therapist gets to say, this is where I'm going to join you. I'm going to be whatever you need me to be.
Yeah.
And we're going to walk through this, because this is the world where this trauma and these reenactments live in that client system.
Yeah. And they live as an experience. I think that's really important. They don't live as a cognition. They don't live as an idea. They live as an experience that the client system is needing to feel and taste and engage on all these different levels. And so Yeah, it is an act of generosity for you as a therapist to say, yes, let me take on this role for you. And, you know, there needs to be safety around it. There needs to be a lot of foundation built and a lot of rapport built before entering that territory. I don't even think we're choosing to go deep. I think the system is choosing to go deep, and you can say yes to that process or no to that process.
I think that's a question that maybe a lot of folks might have. And I did initially, to be honest with you. If we think back in the, you know, 60s and 70s and the bad trips people went on, and we're even using that phrase right now, trips. And but our association with trips is people getting high on mushrooms, people getting high on acid, and these really bad psychedelic trips that people are so afraid of. And sadly, it might have a little bit of that stereotype. But what you're saying here is that the healing process that takes place within the psychedelic trip suggests that the body will on its own access the good path, not a destructive one, but a good path, suggesting that the body doesn't want to hold on to trauma. In fact, it wants to heal. And then once that secondary process is bypassed and the primary conscience accessed with the therapist's role in that transferential piece, it directs us down the right path to heal.
Yeah. The client system is conducting this, is orchestrating this with an intelligence that is profound. I mean, this is not something that I, as a therapist, even with all the theoretical understandings and the maps and strategies that I might bring to the table, it's not something that I, as a therapist, nor the client's ego, their secondary consciousness, will put together. It's coming from a much deeper place.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
Are you preparing for a licensure exam in psychology, social work, marriage and family therapy, counseling, or behavioral analysis? AATBS is here to help. We have been supporting behavioral mental health students to prepare for their licensure exams for more than 45 years, working with over 1 million students to succeed on test day and move on to the next step in their career. With products ranging from comprehensive courses to quiz banks and delivered live online, self-study online, and in print, AATBS has test prep solutions that meet every student's needs and learning styles. Visit us today at aatbs.com. That's aatbs.com. And use promo code BHT15 to save 15% off your next purchase.
Well, you're talking about right now, and something we mentioned earlier, about this collaborative piece with the therapist and the patient, but there's also this collaborative piece that can be accessed between our primary conscience and our autonomic nervous system that first requires, again, that secondary conscious, which can limit and keep us from being able to access where the real work is. But there's this potential for this really synergistic back and forth potentiating process where each of these systems, the primary conscience and the autonomic nervous system, once accessed, can really kind of collaborate in this phenomenal way. Take us into that part of the system.
Yeah, you're referring to what happens when the ANS turns on and becomes a part of the process? Yeah. Let me give a sort of the overview of it, which is that we know from animal research studies that the mammalian nervous system has these sort of escalating stages of responses that it has to thread. And these stages range from sort of mild stress symptoms like anxiety, hypervigilance, muscle tension, and to, you know, high states of stress, meaning panic attacks, huge fight or flight responses, big adrenaline release, you know, like intense muscle contraction, real panic and fear responses, all the way to somewhat numbing dissociative responses or depressive responses. And then finally to much more significant numbing dissociation responses. And so we have a map of how the autonomic nervous system works in terms of threat. And if you take a look on our website, you'll see that a whole lot of what we would consider mental health symptoms are accounted for as a biological response to threat. And so when we enter primary consciousness through the use of a psychedelic, we find that nervous system response is much more accessible to people, right? So normally the body, the nervous system does not want to maintain itself in a traumatized state, right? Especially if we're not in threat, if we're out of danger, the nervous system wants to move back to a calm, relaxed position. And it can't do that for a variety of reasons that I won't go into here. But when you introduce psychedelics to the picture, we find the fluidity, the accessibility to that nervous system response becomes much more available to us. And that happens on pretty much any psychedelic. That happens with cannabis. It happens with MDMA. It happens with psilocybin. It happens with ketamine, right? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a sort of a very basic biological response that we have. And so we articulated a tiered system of how we think that people, particularly with mental health concerns, should enter the psychedelic sphere, right? So the first tier is what I would call the realm of the body. It's the biological compromise that's part of the autonomic nervous system. So basically, if you've had, you know, assaults in your life, if you've had experiences that led you to have to dissociate during them, which the vast majority of us walking around have had those things. Yeah. The first tier is saying, let's address that. Let's address the compromise that you have in your nervous system. If you enter into an intimate relationship and your system just flat out dissociates because, you know, intimacy equals danger in your world, then, you know, that's something to address at the level of the nervous system, right? It's not something to address at the level of insight or awareness. It's like, no, let's just go to the dissociation that got created here. So that's the first tier, right? It's designed to work with the events that have created overwhelm and trauma in a person's life. The second tier is much deeper than that. The second tier works with the identity that got created in response to those events, right? So in other words, you know, if you had, if you've had neglect or abandonment as a child, your consciousness formed a sense of the world, right? You formed a sense of reality that you think is real, that you think is rock solid. Yes. And there is, and this is so implicit. This is so ingrained in us that we have no ability to access it through secondary consciousness. It's just reality, right? But what we find is that people who are operating, who have done the tier one work, their systems naturally move to tier two, which is disassembling that sense of reality and that sense of self that got constructed, and then reassembling a much more stable, healthier configuration from the bottom up, right? So, and again, this is not an orchestrated thing that we can do. It's just something that your system and its extraordinary intelligence conducts on its own with a lot of support.
Yes.
Right. So tier one deals with the events that create trauma in a person's life. Tier two deals with the person, the identity, the sense of the world that got constructed from those events. And then finally, tier three is what most of us are familiar with when we think of psychedelic therapy, which is, you know, the ceremonial work, the people going to Peru and having big ayahuasca, transpersonal medicine experiences. And unfortunately, I think there's a little dark side here, which is that people typically want these big transpersonal experiences because they're suffering, because they have these, you know, developmental trauma issues. And so oftentimes I think what happens is they experience relief when they transcend their ego, but that ends up being a bypass. So we find that many people just need to keep going to the well of the transpersonal because, you know, the transpersonal doesn't care about your trauma, right? The transpersonal, like, it's not concerned about, you know, you, your individuality is the least interesting in the transpersonal world. And so we're suggesting, you know, stay with the tier one until your system moves to tier two, and then, you know, jump into tier three.
Got it. That's really helpful. Yeah. I love this idea that we can track this and watch the whole process organically evolve on its own.
Yeah.
In a way where you're saying when we bring this primary consciousness and the ANS is activated, there's this resolution being possible here. And you're saying they kind of ping off of each other. They potentiate one another. They accelerate, as we said earlier, taking someone to their trauma where we get to trust along again with that therapist's role in this. This is where the healing begins to take place. And this is where the resolution begins to occur.
Yeah.
And let me ask a quick question.
Yeah.
How many psychedelic trips might one do to work through an issue? And how long does a typical trip maybe last in that session? How many and how long?
Okay, let's do how long, because that's the easier answer here, which is, you know, working with cannabis or ketamine, we always schedule out 2-hour sessions simply because, you know, those medicines are shorter acting. Most people will come out of the psychedelic phase, you know, hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes into it. Okay. And then they can spend the last 15 minutes, 20 minutes or so doing some integration work around what happened. Right. Okay. And I'm suggesting integration is important, but in this model, it's secondary, right? So the main brunt of the work, the heavy lifting, happens during the psychedelic experience and the interactions. One of the a phrase that I realize I haven't used in this conversation, Graham, that I typically do when teaching, is that we find that the autonomic nervous system, the body, is a preferential pathway for the psychedelic to take. So basically, once somebody has discovered this nervous system response in their system, then we can introduce a psychedelic and it will almost always take that nervous system pathway. So what I mean there is, you know, you can take a psychedelic and spend, you know, 2 hours or 6 hours talking about what you're experiencing, right? And the insights and everything that are coming. I think that's, to some degree, that's missing the real gift of what the psychedelic is offering, right? So in other words, instead of talking about it, you can feel your way through everything that's happening. You can feel your way into hopelessness and, you know, depression and basically all the symptoms that your system is working with normally you're trying to avoid. The psychedelic will take you right there.
And I watched you in that video do just that. And we were talking, this kind of references, does the body take the good path or could it go down a bad path? And what you're saying right here is it takes the healthy, corrective, resolution-based path. It knows to do that.
Yeah.
And what I watched in your video was that the body is very much engaged in what it feels like to feel disgusting.
Yeah.
What it feels like to feel afraid that you're going to get bored and leave as his, you know, projected father. It really stays in that state, doesn't it?
It really does, yeah. And the beauty of this is we're not directing it. As the clinicians here, I'm not telling anybody that, okay, now feel hopelessness, now feel this, now feel that. We're just setting the container and whatever emerges in it, we will join with the client in that experience. Yeah. So it's their system taking them to these very difficult places inside of them. But back to your question, you know, the sessions are always 2 hours long when we're working with those medicines. When I'm working in Amsterdam with psilocybin, then the sessions are longer. They're at a minimum 4 hours, 4 to 6 hours typically. And now in terms of the arc of treatment, now this is an interesting piece here, right? So I will tell people that the rule of thumb is depending on what they're bringing to the table. So if they've had a stable childhood, if they have good, decent attachment, if they trusted and felt safe with their family and their parents, and intimacy was a good thing for them, then when they were 20 years old, something gnarly happened to them, then I would say it's a very few sessions, right? Yeah. That we're looking at. And in fact, that person probably wouldn't end up in therapy with us in the first place. Like that's the type of person that, you know, they have a sense of goodness about the world and themselves to bounce back upon, and they find their feet again with it. For the most part, we see the person that, you know, they did not have stability in childhood. They did not have, you know, secure attachment with their parents. So that is definitely a much longer arc because we're dealing with trauma there. We're dealing with, you know, developmental processes that turn on. We did a pilot study with combat veterans, and it was a 12-session protocol. And remember, each session is 2 hours. And so typically around session, you know, 2, 3, 4, that's when people really fell apart, right? And let me be clear. Let me be so clear on this point that psychedelic therapy is always, always destabilizing if it's done well, right? So in other words, the medicine, the therapy is going to all the coping mechanisms that you've developed over the years to deal with your life. It's taking that apart. And so you get to see and feel this wound in a much more direct way. And even though that's a difficult experience, it's necessary to heal from it.
That's what takes you to your trauma. You have to destabilize, trusting the larger process involved.
Yeah.
That we're going to reconstruct some things after being destabilized and coming apart.
Yeah.
Putting it back together in a way, having gone to your trauma, that's a much more truth-based, healthier way of being able to live in the world now.
I would say so, right? So we're really looking at, instead of a managed resilience, because you're, you know, managing stress levels and triggers and things like that, I think people get to actually be much more free with it.
Yeah, when you think about it, when you put it this way, is someone really that stable anyway, trying to hunker down around there? They're only going to be as good as until they're triggered next. And then they become destabilized in the worst, most difficult kind of a way, whether it's a PTSD reaction or some kind of reaction that someone has. They're really not that stable to begin with, because they're only going to be as good until the next time they get triggered. What you're saying here is, if we can go through this process, help somebody in a managed and joined way become destabilized. Mm-hmm. That's what takes us to the trauma. And then we get to work through it then and resulting in a much more stable way of being.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's exactly what we're talking about here.
Yeah. So walk me through that trial. So, you know, around the 12th, you know, 10, 11, 12 sessions, mm-hmm. what are you noticing with the combat vets, may I ask?
Yeah, absolutely. So let me just say, these folks were very unstable people coming in, right? They would be considered treatment resistant. They'd gone through the VA, the prolonged exposure therapies, the psychiatric routes. And so coming in, they were wobbly. But then when, you know, session 2, 3, 4, they became even more wobbly, right? And so, you know, that's when we said, okay, well, we developed a number of what I would say resourcing groups, like art therapy integration, restorative yoga, regular talk therapy group, you know, we a women's movement group. We basically developed these groups at our clinical site. So people between their psychedelic therapy sessions, they could come in and just experience connection and resource and stabilizing, which is a hugely important part of the process. So we held them together with that as they were moving through the process. And then, you know, session 9, 10, 11, where their systems organically really started to come back together. Right. And I would say for this particular study, I'm not, you know, and granted, it's a pilot study, so it wasn't a randomized control trial or anything like that. From these folks, basically, they felt like 60-65% of their core trauma was handled by those 12 sessions. And mind you, again, these are veterans with enormous amounts of adult war trauma, but they all also had really significant childhood trauma. And the medicine sessions every single time would go to their childhood and to sort of work with that space first and then build on top of that.
Isn't that interesting? It would default by going back to the origins.
Yeah.
Building from there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a fascinating piece. What are some of the stories you're hearing just in general, Saj, around, you know, this treatment kind of sticking to, such that their lives get to be lived in a very different way without this chaotic, trauma-based, fear-based way of having to contain these things that are so painful and tormenting? When this gets to be resolved, what are you hearing about people's lives post-treatment?
Yeah, we see a lot more stability. We see, again, resilience that's not based in better coping, better management strategies, but resilience that's a function of their bottom-up process, right? We see people being able to do intimacy much better, right? So, you know, the world of, I think, couples therapy can really be affected by this. You know, people are less reactive. They have both sympathetic arousal symptoms. So they have less anxiety. They have less depressive numbing symptoms.
What strikes me is that, again, not to sound redundant, but, you know, there is always the within work and then there's a between work.
Yeah.
A lot of times we try and do the between work before we do that within work.
Yeah.
And what you're talking about, this within work and where you take folks. And when you do the psychedelic sessions, you're doing the sense they have of themselves, their own identity that you're describing, and then how that relationally plays out in the experiences that their system carries. I'm imagining post-treatment, post-psychedelic sessions and work, their within work and their within sense of self is very different.
Yeah.
And also the between with their significant others and in their life gets to be in a much more balanced, much more truth-based sense of who they are as they come into these situations. And if their bodies are not so somatically triggered and set off, they get to come into these more present.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a huge piece that, you know, one way we talk about it is, you know, there's the world of, there's present moment reality, and then there's the world of event memory, which we're all carrying around with us. So all the traumas that we have, you know, your memory of 9/11, for example, the fact that you can remember where you were when 9/11 happened, that's your particular sort of event memory around a cultural trauma that we have. And so the more people are activated and live in, have compromised nervous systems and with trauma in them, the more that they're living and responding from event memory and the less that they're responding to the person in front of them. And so the more we clear out that nervous system charge, the more that they get to live in the present moment, because the present moment's pretty beautiful for most people, right? It's a pretty good place. You know, if they looked around and said, oh, wow, like I constructed this life and it's actually okay here, right? So it's good news when people sort of start leaving the event memory world and come into the present moment. And the thing is, I know there are technologies like meditation that are designed to do that. But I think, again, meditation is a coping strategy in a lot of ways. It helps people really be in the present moment because their bottom-up process is still very reactive, right? So I think meditation coaches people to disconnect from the reactivity and come to the present moment, as opposed to saying, let's process all the parts of you that have this reactivity, like your childhood, for example, and your childhood could also be here in the present moment and take that in.
Yeah. And therein lies the hope of this treatment, which I think is great. So someone's not going to be only as good until the next time their trauma eclipses a moment, which could be really beautiful, and unintentionally they find themselves destroying or hurting or wounding. Yeah. And then they're left with that secondary wounding of those that they love or their own lives. And this is fascinating. I wish we had more time. We're going to have you back for sure. But let me begin to kind of, as we wind down today, I would love you to direct folks to any resources that you could give us today where they could learn more or hear about training opportunities.
Yeah.
Please give us some resources, Saj.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the big one that really, you know, you've heard us touch on sort of different aspects of the model. And the one place that all of that is put together very nicely is a white paper that we recently had published in a peer-reviewed journal of psychedelic psychiatry. And so if you go to psychedelicsomatic.org, we have a link to that white paper on that page. You have to scroll for it and look for it, but it is on the homepage.
It's easy to find.
Yeah. Okay, great. So there's that. And it's like a 35-page paper. So it's really kind of, it has detail in it. The other place you can go is we have a number of different videos. So the responses that you're going to be seeing in these videos and what we're talking about, they're not like, oh, here's the one person that has this response. It's like, no, like we get these responses from everybody, you know? So I would say, look at the videos on the website. And there's one, the one that we've referenced in this talk, Graham, is it's annotated. So it'll walk you through sort of what's happening therapeutically and what we're looking at. And it's like a 24-minute video. It's also on the homepage of the site. Excellent. We train people to do this. And I think we've been revamping our training models. We've run 9 cohort groups through it. And it involves 5 days of training and then a 6-month supervision with me. But I think what we're finding is that people need more support, because here's the thing I think we didn't touch on during this talk that I'll speak to now a little bit, that this work is not for everybody. Right. This, and I mean that both, it's not for every clinician out there and it's not for every client out there. That I think that there are ways of working in therapy and certainly ways of even working with psychedelics that don't go as deeply into primary consciousness and sort of the wild world that we encounter down there. I think that if you bring the body on board, if you bring that nervous system pathway on board and combine it with a psychedelic, it just takes a deep dive. It takes a deeper dive than most people are imagining that can be taken. And so, again, it is quite destabilizing. And if you're the type of therapist that is not comfortable with that, this really is not the type of work for you. There's other beautiful modalities and things that you can really engage in and do. So I'm saying all this as a caveat that I don't think this is for everyone. But if you've listened to this podcast and you're interested in being trained, then, you know, you can send us an email. And if you made it this far, then we'd love to have you.
Well, I think, like you said earlier, there is a brilliance to what we can access with the psychedelics in a supportive, guided, in terms of guided being a supportive place where you're not alone, and some really great things can truly be accessed that allow this healing to take place. And I agree with you also that it's a gift to be able to have this approach. And congratulations on your work. Thank you for it. And it's been great to have you with us today. Thank you for joining us.
Yay, Graham. This has been delightful for me as well. So yeah, thank you.
Thank you. And I want to thank you to our listeners for being with us today. And we'll look forward to having you join us next time on Behavioral Health Today.
We appreciate all the support from our community. And if you like our show, one of the best ways you can support it is by giving us a 5-star rating and leaving a review. Behavioral Health Today is a podcast part of the Tribe Network, all rights reserved.